This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa lover and warm Pacific greetings. I'm Talia Olatia and you're listening to Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the program, it wasn't a pleasant welcome home for the former Papua New Guinean Prime Minister Peter O'Neill over the weekend. After being stranded in Australia due to COVID-19 lockdown measures, Mr. O'Neill flew into Port Moresby Airport on Saturday and was charged by PNG police over the alleged purchase of generators from Israel without parliamentary approval. Our PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting will join us shortly. And Mr. O'Neill hasn't been the only Papua New Guinean stuck in Australia. More than 350 Papua New Guineans are wanting to return home, but confusion and anxiety grows around the promise of a repatriation flight.
We are determined as a country to ensure that we take responsibility to bring in our citizens. We can't expect other countries to play that role for us.
And dozens of Vanuatu citizens stranded in Australia due to border closures are fearful at the risk of becoming unlawful, with their visas due to expire within weeks.
My concern is that their visas are expiring very shortly. And in fact, when I spoke to one just recently, his sister's visa actually expired over a month ago. So my concern is actually she is unlawful at the moment, which is not a good position to be in.
Those stories and more coming up on Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Papua New Guinea's former Prime Minister Peter O'Neill has been one of hundreds of citizens stranded in Australia because of COVID-19 border closures. But when he finally returned home on the weekend, police were there to greet him. He's been charged with misappropriation, official corruption and abuse of office over the purchase of two generators for 50 million kina, or almost 22 million Australian, back in 2013. But the former PM, who was forced to stand aside after growing pressure this time a year ago, claims, quote, shadowy figures are behind the arrest. Our PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting joins us now. Good morning, Natalie.
Good morning, Charlie.
Now, Natalie, it wasn't really the welcome home that Mr. O'Neill was expecting. What happened?
That's right. As you mentioned, Mr. O'Neill has been among many Papua New Guineans who've been in Australia during this lockdown period. He flew back in to PNG on Saturday, the afternoon when he landed in Port Moresby. He was arrested and taken in for questioning in relation to this investigation. So he spent Saturday evening being questioned by police. And at the end of that, as you mentioned, police have charged him with one count of misappropriation, one count of official corruption and one count of abuse of office.
Now, these are related to the purchase of those generators. Do we have any further details about the generators in question and who the alleged seller is?
We do. It's through an Israeli company. There is some confusion. The fraud squads told me that the name of the check was different to the name of the company that was meant to be going to. So there's some conjecture around that. Now, Mr. O'Neill has said that these were purchased to prevent blackouts in Lae and Port Moresby in 2013. He's defended the purchase process. However, the Assistant Commissioner of Crimes has alleged that they were purchased without a proper procurement process, without the approval of Parliament, without tender process.
Mr. O'Neill has also suggested that the current Prime Minister, James Marape, who was the Finance Minister at the time, should also be charged. What else has Mr. O'Neill had to say?
Well, Mr. O'Neill has said that the case is highly politicised. He has said that, as you mentioned, that there are some dark and shadowy figures working behind the scenes. He said he's looking forward to his day in court, quote, so that the truth can prevail and this injustice corrected and exposed. So he has defended the process, but also in that statement that he released, he has said that if the police are independent, why isn't Mr. Marape being charged, as he was the finance minister at the time? So he's certainly you know, brought Mr. Marape into this, as Mr. Marape was the finance minister in 2013.
And so what has the current PNG Prime Minister James Marape said in both in terms of the arrest of Mr. O'Neill and the fact that Mr. O'Neill is kind of pointing the finger at him?
Yeah, so we've seen a brief statement from Mr. Marape released on Facebook saying that he's reassuring the nation that he won't be impeding the work of police as Prime Minister. He did also urge people to respect Mr. O'Neill and the legal process. But in that statement, he said that finance ministers were last in the chain of approval process, and also offered to be submit a witness statement as part of the investigation. So I think there's still some more to unfold.
Indeed. And in that Facebook post that Mr. Marape wrote, he did, as you said, ask for people to be respectful and, quote, refrain from public commentary. But what has been the reaction from the PNG community to Mr. O'Neill's arrest?
Oh, obviously it is attracting a lot of attention, as it would out of any country. As with these issues, it's a highly politicised in terms of people's responses. You know, there are people who are supporting Mr. O'Neill. There are people who aren't. I mean, I don't know that the conjecture is going to help anything in the legal process, but obviously it is attracting a lot of attention. And this is an issue. Obviously, we saw the attempt last year to arrest Mr. O'Neill over a different issue, and him seeking a court injunction challenging the validity of that warrant. So, you know, this more broadly is an issue that that Papua New Guineans have been following for some time.
And Natalie, could there be more arrests on the cards?
Well, that's what's been indicated to us by the head of the fraud squad. He has outlined the matters that are being investigated, and he says he does expect more arrests to be made soon.
Finally, Natalie, where is Mr. O'Neill now? Like I said, he was he boarded a plane from Brisbane to Port Moresby. Presumably he's now got to do the 2 weeks of quarantine. So where will he be doing this?
Well, the police have told us that that he will be allowed bail, and they'll expect him to quarantine at his own residence for the next 14 days. So that's what we've been told officially by police.
So he's allowed to go home and not in one of the hotels that, you know, other people who have to travel back home might be forced to quarantine in?
That was certainly what was said in the statement sent out by police. It did say in his own residence.
Yeah. Natalie Whiting, thank you for joining us for this morning and running us through the news. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Tali.
Thank you. That was our PNG correspondent, Natalie Whiting, there.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Like you heard, PNG's former Prime Minister Peter O'Neill was just one of more than 350 Papua New Guineans who've been stuck in Australia since March, when borders shut very quickly. But there's been the promise of a repatriation flight for weeks, but confusion and anxiety has been growing for many of those who are still stranded. There are conflicting messages about who's responsible for paying for the mandatory 2-week quarantine that returning citizens are being required to do. Bethany Harriman has this report from Port Moresby.
It's been an anxious few weeks for Port Moresby father Manu Bobola.
I just need my son back. Where I can bring him when I come back to Port Moresby. I need my son back.
His son, 20-year-old Ezra Bobola, graduated from the University of Canberra in April with a degree in business informatics. He had been away from home for 3 years. The family had planned for Ezra to return home to PNG when his studies were finished. They'd paid for plane tickets, but incoming flights to PNG were banned by the government in late March, when the country confirmed its first COVID-19 case. Manu Bobola says his son has been working his part-time job at a fast food outlet in order to survive, but money is fast running out because his hours were also cut.
He's actually a part-time employee right now. He's actually paying for his own accommodation. But he needs to come back and finish some school here. He needs to come back to PNG.
His family have been paying for Ezra's weekly rent, which is becoming increasingly challenging. because his father Manu has also been struggling to get work as a consultant during the lockdown in Port Moresby. PNG's national airline Air New Guinea has been selling tickets for flights from the Australian cities of Cairns and Brisbane, but it's not so straightforward. In a statement to the ABC, Air New Guinea said the passengers require specific approval from PNG's emergency controller to be allowed home. It also said passengers need to have evidence of 14-day hotel accommodation at an approved quarantine hotel to be able to check in, which is what Manu Bobola says he's also been advised.
I mean, I can report 4,760 kina, but I don't make 4,760 kina weekly. That's money that's hard to come by. You can't just put one spot and then set the condition as such that you show receipt of purchase of the quarantine facility before you are allowed to purchase ticket.
But the PNG government says it will cover the cost of quarantine. The National COVID-19 Office has told the ABC that it will only cover genuine PNG citizens, those who have gone for holidays or medical purposes, for example. But it hasn't specified what will happen to university students like Ezra. The PNG government has also been promising for weeks that it would coordinate repatriation flights for citizens stranded in Australia, as it has done recently for a small number in the Philippines and Japan.
We are determined as a country to ensure that we take responsibility to bring in our citizens. We can't expect other countries to play that role for us. As Foreign Minister, I've been insisting on the Prime Minister and the Cabinet that we have to do our bit to make sure that our citizens return to our country.
But so far, only a few dozen have been able to return home. More than 300 are still stuck, including Grace Noogie, who's found the government's mixed messaging and delays stressful. She's a doctorate student at the University of Queensland and has wanted to return home since her mother died in late March.
It was beyond our control, so just trying our best to keep a positive mind.
Grace is on an Australian government-funded sponsorship, and she is now turning to them to help foot her quarantine bill just so she can secure a spot on a flight.
I'm relying on the Australian government to get me home, and that's something I'm not very proud of as a Papua New Guinean.
That was PNG doctorate student Grace Noogie. They're still in Australia, but obviously wanting to return home. Bethany Harriman reporting in the PNG capital, Port Moresby. And it's not just Papua New Guineans, of course, who have been stranded during this COVID-19 pandemic. Coming up later on Pacific Beat, you'll hear about the Pacific crew workers stuck on empty cruise ships, wanting to get home but having no place to dock. And you'll also hear about the concerns of Vanuatu citizens here in Australia who are at risk of becoming unlawful when their visas expire.
Tune in to Life Matters on Radio Australia.
When you choose the fair trade chocolate or coffee, do you breathe a sigh of relief and think, good, I'm not exploiting anyone today? I'm really sorry, I have bad news. It turns out that many of the goods we love are still produced under slave-like conditions, and that affects an estimated 40 million people across the world, including in Australia.
What we're talking about is slavery sort of in a form that people might not think about, because people tend to think about slavery in the old days as someone chained up. These days, modern slavery encompasses forced labourers, people who are working against their will, people who are in bonded labour, so they've often paid a lot for a job and indebted to an employer. So it's estimated that there's 25 million people around the world who are working in forced labour. So these are people working in global supply chains that supply and produce the products we use.
Life Matters, 9 a.m. weekdays on Radio Australia.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. Time now to check in with what the weather's doing. And to do that, I'm joined by Neville Coop. He's the director of Nandraki Weather. Good morning, Neville.
Hi, Talia.
How's it looking out there today, Neville?
Yeah, once again, it's a very quiet day across the South Pacific. We have a very slow-moving weather pattern at this time. It's been pretty much stationary now for the best part of 4 or 5 days. And going back to late last week, So not surprisingly, then not much changing each day. So the weather is pretty much settled right across the South Pacific now. High pressure to the eastern New Zealand still dominates.
How's it looking north of the equator, Neville?
There is a bit of weather along the equator, just north of Papua New Guinea and through the Micronesian Islands still. That's associated with a feature we call the Intertropical Convergence Zone, which is sort of the precursor to the monsoon for the Northern Hemisphere for the summer. But at this stage, it's just clusters of thunderstorms popping up here and there, nothing very organised and nothing very significant, but certainly some rain for lots of Micronesia.
Indeed. Neville, thank you so much for the update, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That was Neville Coop there. He's the director of Nandraki Weather. And for weather updates at any time, you can always visit their Facebook page. You'll find them at Nandraki Weather. Time now to find out more about the stories making news in the region and around the world. And to do that, I'm joined by Priyanka Srinivasan. Good morning, Priyanka.
Good morning, Talia. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has indeed. Now, Priyanka, starting off with a tragic story that's made headlines over the weekend. A flea market in Fiji's capital, Suva, has burnt down and police are obviously investigating what's happening. What's the latest?
Yes, that's right. I don't know if you've seen the photos, but they're quite shocking. You can see these billows of massive black smoke that was said to sort of blanket the city when this happened last Friday afternoon. And many people probably know Suva Flea Market. It's quite a big tourist attraction. A lot of people go there when they visit Fiji. It's in the capital, as you said. So it's really sad to see this happen, this whole market be destroyed, and also the nearby Value City shopping complex, which is also well known in Suva. Yeah, as you mentioned, police are still investigating what exactly caused this fire. There have been early reports from the fire authority saying it could be sourced from a restaurant inside the flea market. And then because of the sort of contents of the flea market, it just sort of
domino effect.
Exactly, yeah. Spread through and really got out of hand. There are reports that damages could be in the millions, so quite a lot. And this is particularly concerning because people there, you know, it's their livelihoods to sell this produce, to go to the market and, you know, have their stands there. So some vendors are saying, you know, this is the only way I make money, particularly women. A lot of women stall owners there can be really affected, and you can really feel for them, particularly because of COVID-19 and those impacts as well. So we'll see what's happening, but it's a tragic story.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when you've got a flea market that size, it's not that easy just to go, oh, well, next weekend we'll just set up in a completely different space. Like, and as you said, with everything that's happening with the pandemic as well, for a lot of those vendors, they would have already been seeing a loss in business. So this is just kind of like an extra hurdle that they have to get over. And like, yeah, as you said, it's not good news and not a good time for those Suvan flea market store holders and vendors. But like you said, we will give everyone here updates on ABC Radio Australia when they come to hand. Priyanka, we've also got some exciting news about the story of the six boys from Tonga who were shipwrecked on a remote Pacific island for 15 months back in 1965. What is the latest development in this story?
Yes, I know you've been following it very closely, Talia. Yes, it could be turned into a Hollywood movie, because a Hollywood studio, that's New Regency Studio, they're behind award-winning films like 12 Years a Slave and Revenant. They've won the rights now to tell the story themselves, you know, or at least fund the story. So New Regency Studio won out after an article that we've covered a bit on the show, was published by The Guardian. So that triggered a bit of a battle for the rights over the story. Yeah. The article was based on a book by historian Rutger Bregman, who sort of depicted the story of in 1965 of six teenagers from Tonga who stole a fishing boat hoping to go to Fiji, ended up stranded on Ata Island for 15 months. And it's really a tale of survival. It's been likened to Lord of the Flies and that sort of story.
It is one of those crazy experiences cases. When I was speaking to a Tongan writer, Malika, she was saying it was a story that as a Tongan she grew up hearing about, but it wasn't until this article of Rutger Bregman's book had appeared in The Guardian that I think the rest of the world knew about this amazing story and was like, oh my God, what happened? And of course, the Hollywood people were like, this is a film, because even The Guardian article attracted like 7 million reads. So you obviously know that there is an interested audience out there. I guess the question that a lot of Pacifica people had voiced during Rutger Bregman's article is that Pacific voice and ensuring that there is a Tongan voice, that there is Tongan language, that there is Tongan culture, because a big part of their survival was the fact that they were raised as Tongans to be a community members and good, respectful community members, as opposed to, you know, ending up on Utter Island and then just staging mutiny for themselves. So it'll be really interesting to see where this new Regency studio goes with the telling of this film, because I think that they're going to have a lot of eyes on are you getting this right?
Exactly. Yeah. Are you telling the story, ethically and respectfully? Yeah. We'll see.
And we probably know that Taika Waititi, Oscar-winning director, won't be the director, because he already tweeted out saying, you know, I think you should get some Tongans involved and Tonga film crew in front and behind of the camera, but while also saying I'm not available. So it might not be Taika Waititi, but he is hoping that it might be another Tongan director or up-and-coming
Pacifica
director.
Yeah, that we get to discover. That'll be amazing.
Exactly. So there might still be some good news in that story too. And finally, Priyanka, you have another story linked with an Oscar-winning film, but this time about solar energy for an island in the Solomons. What is this about?
Yes, that's right. It's Oscar buzz this morning. So this story comes to us from the South Australian paper, The Advertiser. So, Talia, have you known what free climbing is? Have you heard of this before?
I just, like, my brain shuts down at the idea of climbing and anyone who does that for fun. And I'm scared if you put free in front of it, because that to me implies that you're doing it without any of the things that you should be doing it with.
Yeah, exactly. You're on the right track. And it's exactly that. It's people who scale these crazy high mountains, death-defying mountains, with no ropes, no harnesses, no safety equipment. So if they fall, they're sort of looking at serious injury and sometimes even death. So Alex Honnold is a front runner in this field. He's climbed, you know, incredible mountains, all free climbing, so without any equipment. And a movie, an Oscar-winning movie, called Free Solo, was all about this and won a BAFTA and an Oscar back in 2019. So why am I talking to you about this? So he actually also has, Alex Honnold, also has a foundation, and he's backing an initiative to bring solar panels to the island of Savo. That's an island in the Solomon Islands. It's a tiny island, only 3,000 people there, but they depend on diesel fuel, which is quite a dirty sort of way to get energy and electricity. So Edward Cavanaugh is the Australian researcher. He's put together this project to bring solar panels to the island and really fuel energy there in a much more cleaner and affordable way, and has this backing from this sort of foundation linked to this Oscar-winning free climber. So it's quite interesting. And they're hoping this could be a blueprint, this project could be a blueprint for other Pacific islands and really help get cheap and accessible energy there. So we'll see what happens.
Isn't it amazing? Alex Honnold, like, you'd think he was crazy, like the idea that he scales mountains without any support measures or safety nets underneath him. I'd be like, I don't trust your judgment on anything you do. But then also looking into clean energy in in the Solomon Islands, I'm like, oh, wait, maybe I do trust your judgment.
Exactly.
It's like, how does your brain work? Please tell us. Priyanka, thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
Thank you.
That was Priyanka Srinivasan there with just some of the stories making it news today.
Coronavirus ME1 planuplo virus of binetang ways have come up in sick one can of sick flu. It may can come up in bagarap long on lapun, no line of city got sick pinis. Here I'm sample something where you can make him long stopping round long display sick. Washing man long you want them soap mark long 20 seconds, stop long way long online, no can go round long on public place, no can all him eye, nose, no mouse blong you, na time you like kush you gonna long and blong you. Suppose you pine him hot long pulling wind, go long out sick or else Santa Claus to long you na kiss him help him.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia. Shortly, we'll bring you the story of the Pacific crew members stuck on cruise ships around the world. But first, a little bit of music. This is Olivia Fawai. The song is Howler.
I was born to move like this. You were born to do this too. You're made to feel this groove. They don't need to understand. I didn't try to play it cool, but we should give them something new. Everyone should take my hand. We don't have to play pretend. Show them how we're different. Kuwa leva leva kafeke he. Kuwa leva kita walue. Haka haka mate mate malie. Taku pepe. And with that look in your eyes, I can see you feel the same way. So just take my hand. Let's take it back.
That was Olivia Fawai there with the song Howler.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
You are listening to Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Talia Olatia. Cruise liners were once seen as the epitome of luxury tourism, but the industry's reputation is in tatters after several ships became the epicentre of coronavirus outbreaks that have led to hundreds of cases and even deaths. Now hundreds of cruise ships are floating empty around the world, apart from their crew. And those crew include hundreds of Pacific Islanders who are stranded and are in limbo. Many are homesick, anxious, and some are calling for their governments to reopen borders so they can finally make their way home. Evan Wasuka has the story.
The cruise ship MSC Ammonia is anchored in the Bahamas, but here in the Caribbean, the ship that normally has more than 2,000 passengers is empty, apart from the crew.
We are doing nothing. We are just sitting and waiting for the time to go home.
Taula Papa Pa'o Lauliliu has been at sea since February and is one of 19 Samoans on board. He says he hasn't been paid since April and is worried about catching COVID-19 because of the high number of cases in the US and that part of the world. A Facebook video he put out calling for help has gone viral and an online petition has picked up hundreds of signatures.
We are really, really want to go back home. Because we need to go back because of we are here in the place of very dangerous and we are afraid of COVID-19.
But in Samoa, the body responsible for recruiting seafarers to work on international cruise liners say Mr. Lauiliu's case is an exception and that hundreds of other Samoans working on cruise ships are safe.
It has created a lot of upset in the families here back home of the sailors that are working. And the sailors themselves have expressed their unhappiness about that video and the fact that it's given their families here the wrong impression.
Lauti Muia Afoa Va'ai is the general manager of Samoan Shipping Services, a government body.
Getting them back home, we are still awaiting until the lockdown period is over. But what the priority now to us at present is to ensure that they are safe where they are housed to await the reopening of the lockdown period.
Mr. Va'ai says five Samoan seafarers on a different ship did catch COVID-19, but now have recovered and are now back at work. Mr. Lauiliu's employer, MSC Cruises, told the ABC they're exploring options available to get crew home, including chartering flights. The company says salaries have been frozen, but crew are being fed and accommodated. But it says ultimately there's little they can do with Samoa's border closed. With protests at home and families calling for their return, questions are now being asked on whether Samoa is obliged to open up its borders for its own citizens.
Well, look, this has been one of the critical questions that every government, large and small, has faced as a result of COVID-19.
Donald Rothwell is a professor of international law at the Australian National University. He says because the sailors are engaged by Samoa Shipping Services, there is some government obligation to get them home.
The fact that it is fully owned by the government of Samoa clearly does create an additional obligation upon the Samoan government to work with Samoa Shipping Services to seek to repatriate their employees effectively back to Samoa where that's appropriate.
Across the world, there are thousands of international cruise ship crews stranded, and Samoa isn't the only Pacific nation to be affected. More than 100 Ni Vanuatu staff working on P&O cruise liners are stranded as well, with their ships anchored in Manila Bay in the Philippines. There have been calls for them to return home in the Vanuatu capital, Port Vila. But with Vanuatu's border closed under a state of emergency, it's also unlikely they'll be home soon. The government previously said it wouldn't repatriate citizens until it had quarantine facilities and COVID-19 testing set up. Professor Rothwell says in the meantime, it might just be Australia that can provide a path home for these stranded seafarers.
We certainly know that there are flights coming into Australia at the moment. Travel into Australia is only available at the moment for Australian permanent residents and Australian citizens, but there are certain exemptions that are granted. And most importantly, and this is relevant for seafarers, of course, merchant ships are still coming into Australia. So there may well be some way in which the repatriation of these Pacific seafarers could be facilitated.
That was Professor Donald Rothwell from the Australian National University. Evan Wasuka, the reporter there.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
There are fears dozens of Vanuatu citizens stranded in Australia amid border closures are at risk of becoming unlawful, with their visas due to expire within weeks. Melanie McFarlane is a migration agent based in Australia. She grew up in Vanuatu as a child and offered her services for free to Pacific Islanders stuck in Australia who are unable to return home during the pandemic. Ms. McFarlane says many of them may be unable or unwilling to pay for visa extensions and is calling for the Australian government to waive the fees so that they can stay in the country lawfully. She spoke to reporter Priyanka Srinivasan and began by outlining her concerns.
My concerns are that, especially having spoken to some of the Ni Vanuatu subsequently, my concern is that their visas are expiring very, very shortly. And in fact, when I spoke to one just recently, his sister's visa actually expired over a month ago. And they had gone to see, I think, a migration agent about it, but it was very expensive for them to renew the visa. They didn't know how to do it themselves. And so I think they left it in the end. And so my concern is actually she is unlawful at the moment, which is not a good position to be in at all. And there are others who are coming up to that point. And they came here for a short visit, but they the majority of them have long-term, let's say 1 to 3 year visitor visas with multiple entry, which means they can come in and out of Australia. In order to have to renew a visa here, they would lose that completely, and it actually costs them quite a lot of money and time in Vanuatu in the first place to apply for that visa. It's an unexpected cost, and I think there is a visa which the government has set up called the it's a 408, it's an existing visa, the 408 visa for special events, and they have set it up for the COVID-19 stream, and it's free to apply for. But the reality is that visa is really for those who are actually working in essential services and they're supported by an employer to apply for it. Whereas those who have a visitor visa are expected to simply apply for another visitor visa. But, you know, it's a big issue. And I see from the point of view of Vanuatu, I think it's a little known fact, actually, that, you know, the Niue Vanuatu contribute enormously to the Australian economy in terms of the work that they as Pacific Islanders do as seasonal workers in agriculture. Obviously, this is unrelated to those who are on visitor visas, but I just feel that there should be some kind of payback in a way, and that perhaps the government could see fit to allow them to extend their visas free of charge. I just think, when a country such as Vanuatu brings such economic benefit to a country such as Australia, then perhaps there could be some return.
And so what options do exist here for those stranded, you know, without this sort of system provided by the Australian government? What options currently exist for them?
Well, the main option is that, Priyanka, it's actually to be able to apply for another visitor visa, which will then entitle them to hold a bridging visa whilst they're waiting for that new visa to be granted. And that keeps them lawful here. As I said, there is the 408 special events visa, but it's not really deemed to be an option for them to apply for, even though it is a free visa to apply for online. So it's really a costly solution for them at this stage.
How much does that cost? How much? What is the
price? Well, the visa itself costs $395. Mm. But, you know, when I was speaking to one of the Niue Vanuatu yesterday, he was saying to me, well, we went to a migration agent and fair enough, migration agent's going to charge for a service, but they were charging about $900 to apply for it. And a lot of, you know, people don't know how to apply for visas themselves. You know, you might think, oh, it's just an online application, but actually it's not. You have to set up an IMEI account, you have to do this and that. And it's complex to someone who you know, has no idea about immigration law and so on. And so it's not just the cost of the visa itself. It's not just the cost of the $395, but some people have come here with their children as well. So it would be $395 times 2 or 3 or 4 plus the cost of a migration agent. You could be looking at $2,000, for example.
And I guess, I know some of the people that we were speaking to earlier, they were saying that they have no current source of income because obviously they've left their jobs temporarily to come visit Australia. But now it's a week-long holiday has become months and they don't have a form of income. Is that some of the concerns as well, that people are looking, you know, to have to extend their visas without any form of financial support otherwise?
Yes, I think that's a good point, because the reality is if you come here on a visitor visa, you need to be able to support yourself when you're in Australia. But if you come for a week, that's fair enough. You can, you know, you're able to do that. But if you are reliant upon that income from a job and you're not able to go back and perform that job and therefore earn that money to pay for your financial support, well, then it becomes a very difficult situation. And it's not surprising that those who are stranded here are finding it very difficult to pay for another visa. So not everyone's visa has expired yet, but the majority are, you know, those visas are coming up for expiry. There's someone I spoke to at the end of this month, somebody in the middle of June. As I said, there was one visa that expired on the 24th of April. So it is a tricky situation. And the only other thing, as I said, that they can do is they can become unlawful and then apply for a bridging visa E to leave the country. But nobody wants to be in that position because of the repercussions and the implications on not only returning to Australia later, but also going to other countries if they wanted to travel elsewhere in the world. It's not good to have become unlawful in any country when you're applying for any other visa. So it would have real impact.
And I'm sure, I understand that you're asking the Australian government, I guess, to make a bit of an exception for the Niue Vanuatu who are stuck here. But is this a problem that I guess is bigger than just this situation? Like, why should Australia help this small group of people when I guess there are thousands of others facing similar situations?
Absolutely. Yes. No, you're right. But when COVID-19 and the effects, what have you hit, New Zealand saw fit to automatically extend all temporary visas for a period of 6 months. And that hasn't occurred here in Australia. I do appreciate the economic repercussions of that too. It's an enormous admin exercise. But yes, it is. These are unprecedented circumstances. And of course, they call for unprecedented actions.
That was migration agent Melanie McFarlane speaking there with reporter Priyanka Srinivasan. And we have requested more detail from Australia's Home Affairs Department, but they're yet to respond.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Let's have a little bit more music. This is Nara Burafera by Jessica Mowboy and Lou Bennett.
Wamraka Moses Yenyen Wala Wala Yapone Buj Nara Burafera Yumanayala Nara Burafera Yumanayala Yala Nara Burafera Yumanayala Yala Nara Burafera Yumana Burafera Yumana Burafera Yumanayala Yala Yenduk peku Jesu, brau bukana yumana, ngaura bura fera yumana yala. Ngaura bura fera yumana yala yala. Ngaura bura fera yumana yala yala. Ngaura bura fera yumana, bura fera yumana. Bura fera yumana yala yala Nara bura fera yumana yala yala Nara bura fera yumana yala yala Nara bura fera yumana Bura fera yumana Bura fera yumana yala yala
The extremely smooth harmonies of Jessica Mowboy, Lou Bennett, and also Juanita Tippins and Jade McRae there with Nara Bura Fera.
Pacific Beat at 6 a.m. and 7 a.m. weekdays on Radio Australia.
Many Indigenous Pacific cultures have hierarchies. Your chief is the most senior and respected person in the village, for example. But when it comes to social media sites like Facebook and Instagram, who and what is the Indigenous authority?
Our engagement with social media, specifically Facebook and Instagram, but also Twitter, fragments what we understand to be traditional forms of communication and hierarchical authority. Because we are dealing with multiple contexts and multiple time zones, collapsed contexts online, it makes it really hard to kind of regulate how people communicate with each other and to build protocols around how people can do that safely and respectfully.
Pacific Beat, 6 a.m. and 7 a.m. weekdays on Radio Australia.
The voice you just heard in that promo was Amele Ungavale, a really interesting chat about how Pacifica people use social media. And if you want to listen to that interview in full, you can do so by visiting the Pacific Beat website or through ABC's news site. But the easiest thing to do is just go into your search engine, look up Pacific Beat social media, and you'll be able to see all the stories that talk about social media, including that one from Amele Ungavale.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
You are listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia. With audiences forced to stay home and the banning of mass gatherings, artists and artistic groups around the world have had their work thrown into disarray during the COVID-19 pandemic. However, in a positive sign over the weekend, the art wheels are starting to turn again in Vanuatu with the premiere of a new play from one of the Pacific region's leading theatre companies. While the play's creators are aware of their unique position, as Nick Fogarty reports, they're more concerned about providing locals with a sense of community in difficult times.
Over its 30-year history, One Small Bag Theatre has grown to be not only a respected theatre company, but also one of the Pacific's leading community education groups. As the COVID-19 pandemic took hold and nations across the globe began shutting their borders, Vanuatu's government called on One Small Bag to create a series of awareness videos.
Sigue coronavirus is unstable. Any had something with money touching.
Vanuatu has so far avoided any COVID-19 infections, but social distancing measures and the loss of tourist dollars on top of the devastation of Tropical Cyclone Harold in April has made it a tough year for the public. Still, One Small Bag has managed to launch a new play called Long Time We Long Time I Pass, which is based on a series of fables and custom stories from Vanuatu and around the world. Live theatre, cinema screenings, music concerts and other artistic pursuits have ground to a halt during the COVID-19 pandemic, with many artistic industries decimated. Those few performances that have been possible have made headlines, and audiences have jumped at the chance to watch live streams. One Small Bag scriptwriter, Joanne Doris, says while their performance may be getting more outside attention than usual, she's focused on making it accessible to local people.
In a way, I think because we're some sort of little tiny dot in the Pacific Ocean, of course, we don't really get an awful lot of international interest. So in Vanuatu, we're here and that's what we do. And people expect to come to the theatre at this time of year. But I think our big worry this year is actually that people won't have bus fares. So whether they will be able to come in the numbers that they normally come in, where the theatre's absolutely packed. It's strange. It's such a strange atmosphere here because so much has changed and yet nothing has changed. So the carver bars are full, the churches.
One Small Bag's artistic director, Peter Walker, says it hasn't been the easiest play to stage.
There is this thing, even in the lead up to the performance, you know, how close together do we put the chairs? And in the end, like many strands of society here are sort of saying, let's keep the hygiene and the hand washing and the hand stations that have been put outside, washing stations that have been put outside all stores and everything. But for now, let's hold the memory of social distance should it actually one day reach here. While it isn't, let's do the things that make it a vibrant place to be and to help to some extent cope with also the underlying, still as everywhere, economic disaster.
This vibrancy and optimism has come through in the lighthearted tone of much of the play, Peter Walker says.
And I think that many of the audience at the opening actually responded with relief that it wasn't some very intense piece, but was in a way, some people saying, I haven't actually managed to laugh as much as that for quite some time. And I think there's still a place for that in trying to create a healthy society in town.
And it's not just the audience that stands to benefit. Peter Walker says it's been equally therapeutic for the play's actors.
I think in this particular play, they've actually partly just brought their sort of, look, we've got to find some way of getting back to acting. Acting for many of them is something they've known all their lives. So it was sort of a joint venture in that sense.
That was artistic director of Vanuatu's One Small Bag Theatre, Peter Walker, ending that report by Nick Fogarty.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Pacific Island countries have some of the world's highest rate of diabetes. Studies have estimated as many as 2 in 5 people over the age of 40 have the disease. It's also the fastest growing chronic condition in Australia. And now new research shows just how extensive associated health risks are for patients living with diabetes. It's found people living with type 2 diabetes have a 60% higher chance of developing dementia. And they're twice as likely to develop certain types of cancer. Sarah Segde reports.
In her 2 decades of living with type 2 diabetes, Lynette Luther has managed her condition through medication and a healthy lifestyle.
I try to keep as fit as I can. I'm not a sporty person. Now I walk, I do a meditation in the morning, then I do Qigong. I'm very fussy about food. I try to avoid all processed food. You know, I see people and they've got their takeaway food and I think, oh my God, how can you eat that stuff?
The 73-year-old is among the 1.5 million Australians living with type 2 diabetes. And now new research from the Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute highlights the risks they face of other serious complications. Professor Jonathan Shaw is the lead author.
We now recognise that diabetes increases the risks of certain cancers. It puts people at higher risk of developing dementia and cognitive impairment. It's becoming a major cause of liver disease. So the effects of diabetes go much further than I think we used to think.
The report shows people with type 2 diabetes are up to 8 times more likely to experience heart failure and are at greater risk of liver, pancreatic, bowel, endometrial and breast cancers. Last year, that risk became a reality for Lynette Luther.
The breast cancer was very, very early. I had the surgery and I had radiotherapy and it's all gone. So that is really good. I'm aware of what can happen if your diabetes gets out of control. And dementia is one thing that really worries me. So it's another reason why I do so much meditation.
Associate Professor Michael Woodward is a geriatrician and honorary medical advisor to Dementia Australia.
The link between Alzheimer's and dementia and diabetes is very clear, but we don't know in all cases the exact mechanism. There's a number of theories for why this may be so. It could be related to vascular or blood vessel changes that occur in diabetics more than in other people. It might also be related to interactions between enzymes that degrade the toxic protein that causes Alzheimer's, and we call that protein amyloid, and the effects of insulin on that protein.
Type 2 diabetes is usually diagnosed in adults, but increasingly younger people are developing it too, and this worries Professor Shaw from the Baker Institute.
We have over the last 10 to 20 years seen the numbers of younger people developing type 2 diabetes increasing. We see this mainly in younger adults, but we do occasionally, and particularly in Indigenous populations, see it in adolescents and sometimes even in children. And the challenge there is that many of the complications of diabetes are related to how long you've had diabetes.
Lynette Luther is well aware of the risks and is staying focused on keeping optimistic.
I feel great. I got it. You know, it was mind over matter to some extent. You just tackle it each day as it comes and keep a positive, happy attitude and hope that everything works out.
That was type 2 diabetes patient Lynette Luther, ending that report by Sarah Sedgi.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Let's squeeze in a little bit more music. This is a Tongan choral group singing Muli Tupe.
Oh,
Those beautiful Tongan voices keeping up with that well familiar sound of the drum beat. That was a Tongan choral group singing Muli Tō Pea. Aren't their voices just beautiful? That is all for Pacific Beat for this morning. Don't forget that Richard Ewart will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. So keep listening to ABC Radio Australia and make sure that you also follow and like the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page as well, so you can ensure you get the latest news and developments from around the region. We're also on Twitter. If that's where you're at, you'll find us at Radio Australia, so you can tweet us any stories or anything you want. Just send us a tweet at Radio Australia. Stay safe, be kind to yourself and to others, and I'll catch you tomorrow for more Pacific Beat. See you then.